Welcome to the SEI podcast series, a production of the Carnegie Mellon University Software Engineering Institute. The SEI is a federally funded research and development center sponsored by the U.S. Department of Defense and operated by Carnegie Mellon University. A transcript of today's podcast is posted on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcast. My name is Suzanne Miller. I'm a principal researcher here at the SEI, and today I am very pleased to introduce you to David Svoboda, a researcher on the CERT Secure Coding team. In this podcast, we will discuss his recent analysis of the Java and C coding languages to see which one is more secure. First, a little bit about our guest. David is a software security engineer at CERT SEI. He co-authored and contributed to 4 books, including the CERT C coding standard and the CERT Oracle Secure Coding Standard for Java. David has over 15 years of Java development experience, starting with Java 2, and his Java projects include Tomcat servlets and Eclipse plugins. He also maintains the SEI CERT coding standard wikis, and he has taught secure coding in C, C++, and Java all over the world to various groups in the military, government, and banking industries. David is also involved in several ISO standards groups, including one for standardizing C and one for standardizing C++. He has been the primary developer on a diverse set of software development projects at Carnegie Mellon University since 1991. His projects have ranged from hierarchical chip modeling and social organization simulation to automated machine translation, known as AMT. His CAN2 automated machine translation software, developed in 1996, is still in production use at Caterpillar Industries. Welcome, David. You're a busy guy.
Hello, Suzanne.
So you did this analysis on the security of the coding rules for C language and Java language, and you posted that in a blog, and you've had over 50 comments from Hacker News, which may not be, that's a little bit different kind of resource than the SEI Insights blog, but that's pretty spectacular to get that kind of conversation going. So why don't you tell us a little bit about why you decided this analysis was needed and why you think this has generated so much discussion within that part of the community?
Well, the analysis actually started because of an argument I had with my boss. A little bit of history. We developed the first version of the C coding standard in 2008. Mm-hmm. And then we started to work on the Java standard, and that was first published in 2011. And the Java standard was actually proposed to us by a student who said, you know, your C standard is cool, let's build one for Java. And we thought,
fair enough.
We thought, sure, this will be easy. Java's a secure language. You're not going to find any rules. And the student proceeded to do what students always do best, which is show us just how spectacularly wrong we were.
Okay.
So
from there...
From there, we wound up with about 100 rules in C and 170 rules in Java. And, well, so my boss basically suggested, gee, Java has so many more rules than C. I thought it was a more secure language, you know, implying that the number of rules was, you know,
was directly correlated.
Yeah, with the actual security of a language.
Yeah.
Now, of course, neither he nor I think that's academically rigorous, the number of rules. But, you know, it's still strongly intuitive. It's a pretty important metric because it indicates, you know, how much you have to learn in order to program securely.
Right. You've got to learn more rules in Java than you do in C if you want to create secure code.
Well, that was the argument.
Okay.
And so the point of this analysis was to try and refute that argument, that Java is not a less secure language just because it has more rules.
I see. Okay.
That's why we did the analysis.
And is that what you found when you actually completed the analysis?
And that is exactly what we found when I completed the analysis. So first of all, as I've said, if you look at this first bar graph, you can see that Java has more rules overall than C.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to try focusing on the most severe rules. All of our rules have a severity metric, and the highest value in the security metric indicates a rule where if you violate it, someone can take over your computer.
Okay. So the higher the severity metric, the more important that security rule is to follow.
Exactly. The more critical it is to follow, the more you're going to lose if someone attacks you there. Yes. The lower security rules, you know, they can only just make an attacker crash your program, but not necessarily act. Yeah. Minor details. It's easy to restart such a program. But anyway, the point is that the red in the graph here shows the number of high severity rules in both C and Java, and as you can see, they're very close.
Mm-hmm. And so, actually, C is a little bit higher, according to
C is indeed higher, but it's only, I believe, 32 versus 29 rules.
Yeah, so it's not a huge number in terms of...
Exactly. Not
when you translate that into practice, it's not going to make a huge difference.
So at that point, I was saying, what gives? We thought Java was a more secure language. Why are there just as many high-severity rules for it than there are for C? There are plenty of types of vulnerabilities in C that you don't have to worry about in Java, such as memory corruption. Buffer overflows are a problem almost exclusive to C. Mm-hmm. A couple of languages like C++ have it too. But Java was designed to prevent buffer overflows and memory corruption. And so all of those C rules should have gone away and not appeared in Java. And we don't see that at all in this bar graph.
Right. That's not visible. So what's up with that?
That was the main focus of this analysis. The next thing I did was I simply took the high severity rules and I said, why is this rule high severity? We categorized them and they fell into four categories that you can see in the two pie charts. In the two pie charts here, I wound up with four categories for C and four categories for Java. So as you can see in C, the biggest category is memory corruption, and the biggest Java category is internal privilege escalation. So again, the intuition should hold. Memory corruption is the biggest part of C, and there's no memory corruption in Java.
Right.
So what's going on? So a large part of the blog is spent addressing what these categories are, what is memory corruption, privilege escalation, and so on. So the main point to note was actually the privilege escalation. Both C and Java have rules about privilege escalation, but privilege escalation is a different problem in both C and Java.
Okay.
So first of all, privilege escalation itself just simply means that you have a privilege system, such as a lock on your door, and that a privilege escalation vulnerability is if someone's able to get past your door,
even though they don't have a key.
Yeah. I mean, I have a key to my office door, but that key doesn't let me into your office or most of the other rooms in the SCI. And to have a privilege escalation vulnerability, you have to have a system of privileges. If we took all the locks off here, then my skeleton key wouldn't get me anywhere forbidden. But taking all the locks off will have other problems you don't need to worry about.
Other security issues.
Right. So the difference between C and Java is that Java has its own privilege system that it uses to chaperone things like applets.
Okay.
That's how you are able to run a Java applet on your computer that doesn't have code that you necessarily know or trust.
Right.
At the SCI here, we've used Java applets to do refresher courses on new policies, recognizing terrorists, sexual harassment, that kind of thing.
Right.
Refresher courses that everyone here is supposed to take. And those have been using Java applets even as recently as last year. And so those Java applets are kept secure by Java's internal privilege system.
Okay.
Now, C has no internal privilege system. There's nothing defined in the language. So if you write a C program and I run it, that program can do anything.
There's no chaperone, as
Yeah, there's no chaperone.
Right.
Exactly. Now, there are external privilege systems that most operating systems provide. If you've ever tried to run a program or do something and your computer pops up and says, I need an administration password to do that, that is the
admin system. We see
that
a lot at the SCI.
Yes, we do. Sometimes I even know the password to use, and most of the time I don't. But, Windows and Linux, other computers will have these privilege systems, but they are not part of a programming language.
Right.
So
as a programmer, I not only have to know my programming language rules, but if I don't have rules that cover situations like privilege, I need to also know how to use the rules that are provided by the operating system.
Right.
So that adds a little bit of a layer of complexity in terms of how I use that language.
Right. So the rules with regard to an external privilege system apply to both C and Java.
Okay.
But in C, they're just this small wedge. And, we haven't put them into Java simply because these rules were part of the section of the chapter that dealt specifically with POSIX.
Okay.
And there's a handful of rules as well for Windows. But in Java, the rules, the big rules that we have here in the big wedge, the big blue wedge, deal with Java's internal privilege system.
Okay.
So, again, what you have is both languages have rules about privilege systems. And what happens is if you take those privilege systems away, then you wind up with the second bar chart where you still have a bunch of rules, but suddenly there's many less high-severity rules in Java than there are in C. And that means that if you are not writing a program that works, that interacts with a privilege system, you don't have to worry about that category of rules.
Right. So you have fewer rules to worry about.
You have fewer, well, you have fewer high-severity rules to worry about.
Yes,
exactly.
High-severity rules.
So the upshot is, if you're not working with Java's internal privilege system, and by that I mean you're writing a Java desktop app or a mobile app or even an applet, then you don't have to worry about all of those privilege rules, and the amount of high-severity rules you have is this little red sliver as opposed to that big red stripe that you have if you're in, if you're working in C.
So when you were conducting this analysis, are there things that surprised you that you expected to find but were not the way you had expected?
Well, like I said, in the first bar graph, we see that the number of high-severity rules in C and Java were about equivalent.
So that was a surprise.
That was a surprise. Okay. It was counterintuitive. I expected there to be a lot less in Java because, again, we don't have that whole memory corruption
section.
This is
why we do these analyses, so that we can check on our
intuition
and understand what the real data is.
The analysis was trying to give some scientific rigor to our intuition.
Okay. And so, how can developers use this system? What kinds of things are you seeing on the different sites that are discussing this? What do they see as the major takeaways from this?
So the major takeaway, again, is in this third bar chart, is that if your program does not require escalated privileges, if you're not working with unprivileged code, then you have less high-severity Java rules to worry about than C rules.
Which theoretically should make it easier to write secure software
exactly.
in Java.
Exactly. It should be much easier to write software that doesn't get pwned. And that matches our intuition that Java was a more secure language than
All
C.
Right. Fair enough. So you have other things besides these kinds of analyses that you're doing. What are some other projects that are coming up from the secure coding team that
many
people
other
have to
things.
Look forward to?
Right now I'm doing four projects. Half of my time is spent working on a project called the Source Code Analysis Lab. And in this project it's a very simple business model. You give us some code and we will tell you if this code violates any of our secure coding rules and exactly where. And that includes the C rules and the Java rules, depending on your code's language.
Sure.
And we'll basically give you a report saying we found the following problems.
Okay.
And if we don't find any problems, then we'll declare your code as compliant with our standard and give you an ISO certificate and put you in a registry. And hopefully our certificate, you can use that as marketing to say, our software is secure, it passed the cert C scale standard.
And as we get into more Internet of Things and more kinds of not as common areas that we think about software being an impact, these kinds of certifications are one of the ways that people can gain trust that even though, I don't expect people who build light bulbs to understand coding, they at least are applying secure coding practices and things like that.
The big problem with security is if you have to choose between two software projects for your next purchase, are you going to choose the one that's more secure or the one that's less secure? To answer that question, you have to be a security expert. Most people are not. And most people will go with the one that's cheaper or the one that has more features. Being more secure is not
in the public eye.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not a soluble point. So if the more secure product can give a certification, can say, hey, here's a cert stamp seal of approval, then that becomes a marketing feature.
So that's only one of four projects you're on.
That's only one of four projects. The second project, it's a lens project to try and help improve scale and software analysis by guessing which reports, diagnostics from a tool are likely to be true and which ones are likely to be false positives. So the problem with most analysis tools that look for vulnerabilities and bugs is that they tend to report problems that are not really there.
I see.
We call those false positives. And we hope to be able to take a look at a code base and a set of these reports and say which ones are false and which ones are true, which would help an auditor, you know. It would not be as good as an auditor. Not a human being would still need to look
sure.
at it, but they can helps prioritize.
Them hone in on
they can
the
focus
things.
On the things yeah. the machine thinks is true, and which ones the machine thinks is false, they can discard those.
Right. Excellent.
So that's another project, and that's also taking half of my time. A third project I'm working on is to help
your classic
finish.
Software engineer, Dave.
Yes. The third project is to help finish the CERT secure coding standard for C++.
Okay, that
We've
makes
had
sense.
A C++ standard in the works for several years now, and it is our goal to finish it, and that's taking up half of my time.
All right.
And the last project...
We're up to three halves.
And the last project is automated code repair, and that simply takes the notion that, well, so we have a program, and we know that it has a vulnerability on line 46. Is there some way we can automatically fix this without forcing a developer to go through and manually do it?
You know,
or suppose it has 100 vulnerabilities on line 46, 52, 59.
Right.
You know, asking a developer to fix one vulnerability is pretty simple. Asking them to fix 100 is going to take a long time.
Especially with all the interrelationships that are likely.
Exactly. So if we can write a tool that would do this automatically, or would do this saying, would you like to fix, you know, these five things, just,
right.
you know, press this button, then, you know, that would improve... That would raise the state of coding and you know,
I think that's
reduce
developer cost. That one's going to take more than half your time.
Well, it's currently slated at, I think, 30% of my time. But that puts me at, what, 180%?
Oh, let's not go there.
Yeah.
Like I said, you're like every software engineer I know. You take on more, and researcher, you take on all the interesting things, but it takes time to do all of them.
Yes, usually time that I could be better sleeping.
So... David, I want to thank you for joining us today. This is the kind of work that the SEI is known for doing, for providing this kind of analysis and validating or contradicting our intuition, so with real data. So that's a great service. If you'd like to find out more about David's work in this area, insights, insights.sei.cmu.edu is where you'll find the blog that got all this discussion started. And so... if you want to see, listen to the podcast, it will be on sei.cmu.edu/podcast, along with the transcript. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching.